Welcome to Session 12 of Acts, the Expansion of the Church. This is actually also part two of the time that they were spent in Ephesus on the third missionary journey. And the title of the teaching is called Dealing with Idolatry. So you can open up to Acts 19. We're going to just review a few verses that we read last week, but we didn't talk about very much. And Acts 19 and verse 18. And many of those who believed came and declared their faults and confessed what they had done. They were talking about how people had been into magic and the occult and different kinds of sorceries. And that was very prevalent in Ephesus, if you recall from our last session, some of the things we were talking about, the whole culture in Ephesus was geared around the worship of Diana as well as practice of magic and the occult. So these sorcerers, goes on and says in verse 19, many sorcerers also gathered their books and brought and burned them for everyone. And they counted their price, and the silver amounted to 5,000 pieces. And so with great power the faith of God grew strong and increased. Having that sentence, like a summary sentence right there in verse 20 after what had happened, shows that part of, because they were burning their books and dealing with the sorcery and getting rid of the things that had to do with the magic and incantations and things like that, those are the kind of books that they burned during this time. And it says it counted their price and the silver amounted to 5,000 pieces. And I believe last week I also said that that would have meant in our day and time about $500,000. But I reviewed that and 5,000 in Aramaic can also be translated 50,000. And that's what the Greek says. It's 50,000 pieces of silver. So one piece of silver would be equal to a day's wage. And if you figure just an average of $100 a day in our culture is a, you know, it's actually a fairly low rate wage, but an average wage, you multiply 50,000 times 100, that's actually $5 million. $5 million worth of books. So these were not just, you know, your dime novels that we're throwing in the fire. They were books that were hand copied, that were treasured, that were passed down from generation to generation, and were prized possessions that had these magical incantations in them. And only people who studied the sorcery knew what those symbols meant and things like that. And that is what they were burning. And in those kind of situations, one of the biggest points that I want to, like, just talk about a little bit later, too, is that when you have a book that has so much invested in it that has to do with the occult, magics, the spells, different words that are used in incantations, things like that, you can't just give them away and say, oh, well, it doesn't matter. I'll just give it to somebody else. Those are the kind of books that need to get burned. And then we're going to see why in a little while. So let's go on and read from verse 23. And during that time, a great uproar occurred about the way of God. Sometimes it's called the way of God or the way of the Lord. And there was there a certain worker of silver whose name was Demetrius, who was making shrines of silver for Artemis, which is also Diana, right? And he brought great profit to his fellow craftsmen. So this Demetrius, he was a certain worker of silver or a silversmith. And I believe also last week I was talking about how the little silver amulets were of Diana, and she's a goddess who has a moon over her head, and she has many breasts, and she's a statue that was in the temple. But further looking at this, when it says that he made shrines of silver, was he actually made a picture of the temple with a Diana in the middle of it. So he would have this amulet that would be the temple with all the columns and everything, and then the image of Diana in the middle of it. And they made them in different sizes too. They made them either small that you could carry in your pocket or something like that, or you could have a larger one made that you could put in your home. So there are various sizes in it. These craftsmen were making a lot of money making these shrines. Now, it's really interesting because in archaeology, they have not really found any silver images of Diana. There's a lot of terracotta ones. And if you want to have fun sometime, you can go on YouTube and actually take a tour of Ephesus, of the ruins that are there right now, but also like a video screen image of what the buildings would have looked like during the time of Paul. It's really fascinating. And in that video and in a lot of different places, you can pull up a picture of what Diana really looked like. And she was not pretty at all. Now, I found out something else interesting about Diana or Artemis, is that her Canaanite name was Ashtaroth. And Ashtaroth is Baal's consort. So Baal and Ashtaroth were the god and goddess that were worshipped by the Canaanites, which God was always so angry about, and how he had told Joshua to get rid of all the Canaanites and kill them, was because of the worship with Baal and Ashtaroth. And I've read a lot about the kind of things that the Canaanites did. I mean, burying their babies in the walls of their houses, and focused on the fertility and the promiscuity of that whole worship. So that's the same goddess, only just a different name and a slightly different history. So what is an idol? Don't you think that's a good question?
Mm-hmm.
What is an idol? So I found a definition in a Bible dictionary that was really kind of good. It says, an image of or anything used as an object of worship in place of the true God. So that could be anything. It could be music. It could be our job. It doesn't have to be an idol like a little statue with a temple around it with columns in it. So in our culture, an idol could be a piece of clothing. It could be a title. It could be a position. Anything used as an object of worship, I think that's the key part of it, is it's not that having beautiful things is wrong, or having nice clothes, or even a position, or a good job. None of that is wrong of itself, but when it becomes an object of worship, no matter what it is in our lives, then it becomes an idol. And I want to read from Deuteronomy, because we're going to just focus for a few minutes on objects particularly, because objects can carry different kinds of things on them. And again, objects of themselves are not necessarily good or bad, but they can carry things on the object when they are, it's called devoted to destruction. And I'm going to read it to you from Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 7, and in verse 25, says, the carved images of their gods you shall burn with fire. Now see, this is also something along with the books. These are the things that need to get burned. A carved image of a god. You shall burn it with fire. You shall not covet the silver or the gold that is on them, or take it for yourselves, lest you be ensnared by it. For it is an abomination to the Lord your God. So those are the criteria about whether something is a cursed thing or an object has some something evil about it or associated with it and why you should burn it. Let me read that again. The carved images of their gods you shall burn with fire. You shall not covet the silver or the gold that is on them or take it for yourselves, lest you be ensnared by it. For it is an abomination for the Lord your God. And you shall not bring an abominable thing into your house and become devoted to destruction like it. You shall utterly detest and abhor it, for it is devoted to destruction. That's the reason why we need to go through our houses. And even though this is Old Testament and there is a, you know, it's about the law and it's the explanation of how they should determine whether something was a good object or a bad object. But it is still the same because the adversary has not changed. And he uses objects or things in our possessions to do this same thing. If the object itself is devoted to destruction, then it needs to be burned or destroyed. Because when you bring it into your home, then it has authority and power that the enemy can use against us. That's the main reason. Now I'll give you some example of some objects. Like, what kind of objects are we talking about? And these are not, again, no object, I don't care what it is evil or good of itself. But when it is devoted to destruction, then the enemy can use it. And those are the ones that we need to go in our homes or our friends' homes or our family's homes and just help walk by the Spirit to ask God, is there something in my home that the enemy can use? An example are owls, frogs, even little geese there's a particular kind of goose that has a blue ribbon around its neck that is a god, actually, in history. And there's a lot of people now who are collecting those little goose, that particular kind of goose. Some other examples are Cocopelli dolls, which are very prevalent in Colorado and in New Mexico, and in Arizona as well. They look like a sprite with a little flute, and you think, oh, there's nothing wrong with that. But that is also a god, and it's the same one that was used with Pied Piper of Hamelin, which it looks like it's a happy god, but it's the jesting god, and so that's what it causes. And somebody puts that on the door of their house, they're inviting that spirit to come in. Another example is dream catchers or different American Indian objects. And again, not every American Indian object has evil associated with it. But the dream catchers particularly are because they're circles and they have an entryway for the spirits to come in that dream catcher. Masonic symbols and Masonic items, rings, books, anything to do with Masonic temple worship, and all of the subsidiary type of organizations that are similar to that. The Freemasons were very adept at using symbols to be the key to control and power and evil. So those are just a few examples. There's many others. And again, as I said, you know, there could be something with a wreath. There could be something with dried flower arrangements. There's any object, actually, even like a good luck charm that somebody would wear around their neck, magnets. And as I'm speaking, you can start to see that how the New Age movement that is in our culture is very similar to the time of Ephesus. And we look at it and go, oh, well, we don't have any magic or incantation books laying around in our house. But wait a minute, you know. The people that deal with a lot of the New Age concepts like crystals and even some, remember I said some acupuncture, different things like that, they're right on the edge of this magic. The the same thing. And so someone can, for example, be involved and live in Sedona, for example, all right? But Sedona is a vortex, and it's used by spirits, and it's a center for the New Age. And so you would have to be walking very, very carefully in order not to be affected by that. So it's not, again, something to be afraid of or something to get all weird about and think that there's spirits behind every object. Oh, no, what are we going to do? We have to, you know, throw everything away. You know, we can't keep these pictures and we shouldn't have these records and whatever else, you know, it kind of gets you thinking, well, is there any good objects, you know? And that's not the point. The point is that there are objects that have a doorway for spirits to come in. And when you get rid of them, it's amazing how freed the things change in the environment. And I'll give you one example of a time when I was in Romania and actually did not witness this directly, but there was a girl, she was a young girl, probably about four or five, who had a chronic crying. She was crying for a very long time. I don't remember even exactly how long. And people had ministered to her and prayed for her and laid hands on her and all these different things, and nothing was getting better at all. So they were sitting, there was a group of people, and they were sitting in a living room, and the minister who had been visiting was looked down, and underneath the coffee table was this crystal vase. It was a beautiful object, and it kind of had like facets on it, and it sparkled, and it was a prized possession of the people in this home. And when he saw that object, he said, that's the doorway. That's where it is. And so that when they took it out and they smashed the crystal, the girl stopped crying just like that. So it was so direct. Now, often you can't see it that direct, but when we are careful about what's in, coming into our homes and watch over it, then it's a good thing. It's walking by the Spirit that really tells the difference. Okay, let's keep on reading here. Acts 19. So Demetrius was making these silver shrines, and he brought great profit to his fellow craftsmen. This man gathered all his fellow craftsmen and those who worked with them and said to them, men, you know that all our trade is from this occupation. Can't you just see him being really stuffy, like, I'm the big guy and I know what I'm doing? And you have also heard and you have seen that this Paul has persuaded and turned away not only the citizens of Ephesus, but also a multitude of all of Asia, saying that those are not gods that are made by the hands of men. Oh, so what Paul was saying was that the gods that were made by hands were not true God. He was leading and preaching to them about the true God and about the Lord Jesus Christ. And people were getting rid of their shrines and their amulets and their books. $5 million worth of books is a lot of money. And that had obviously affected the sales of the little silver shrines. Verse 27, and not only this business is being shamed and brought to nothing, but also the temple of the great goddess Artemis, or Diana, is counted as nothing. And also the goddess whom all Asia and all the Gentiles worship is despised. So that's, the first thing was, we're losing money. The second thing is, Diana, who is our object of great worship, right? That's the definition of an idol, is an object of worship. She would be despised. And all Asia worships her. So money, see, and the power that comes with money was coming into the central city of Ephesus. And that's what he was able to stir up the people about. So verse 28, and when they heard these things, they were filled with fury and cried out and said, great is Diana of the Ephesians, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. And the whole city was stirred up. And they ran together and went to the theater. Now remember that when I was describing the street that goes to the theater, there's a huge street that's 100 feet wide, made of marble, that goes from the harbor all the way to the theater. So you can see all the people coming from all the side streets to that main street and just becoming a huge mob going all the way to the theater. The mob was filled with rage. And it also says they were filled with confusion. And remember that verse about with confusion is every evil work? Well, that's kind of what is going on here. They were filled with rage. Verse 30. And verse 29. And the whole city was stirred up. And they ran together and went to the theater. And they seized and took along with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonian men, the companions of Paul. Aristarchus is from Thessalonica, and Gaius, I believe, was from Berea. So they were from Macedonia. And they were the companions of Paul, so they hadn't found Paul, but they found these two guys who were with Paul, right? And they grabbed them, and so you can kind of see, if you've ever seen a mob at all, it's like it becomes a wave where it's just carried through. I wanted to read a description of this, how it might have looked. This is from the Teacher's Commentary on the Acts of the Apostles. This is an out-of-print commentary too, but it's really fabulous. He goes, the illiterate artisans, soured by reduced wages or want of employment, were roused into a state of frenzy, and full of rage, they sallied forth into the streets to wreak vengeance on the object of their blind fury. The living mass rolled along, and thousands of idlers, whom the games had attracted to Ephesus, swelled their numbers at every step, and the whole city was soon in a state of confusion. Isn't that a great explanation of it? It's like, ooh, and then all of a sudden it just becomes a sea and mass of people going to the theater. All right, verse 30. And Paul wanted to enter the theater, yet the disciples prevented him. So the disciples knew better what would happen when the mob got together, like even when they had the games, 25 to 50,000 people in that theater watching bloody games were enough of a mob that they knew that if Paul went in there, he was not going to be coming out. And so they prevented him from going in there. Verse 31. And also the chiefs of Asia, because they were his friends, sent and begged him not to give up his life to enter the theater. Isn't that cool how they protected him and really stood up for him and didn't allow him to go in there? But Gaius and Aristarchus are in there, so what's going to happen to them? Wow. Verse 32, and the crowds that were in the theater were very confused and were crying one thing and then another, for many of them did not know why they had been gathered. And that's pretty much a summary of a mob mentality is by the time you get it all going and everybody's all riled up, they don't even really know why they're riled up. And it kind of reminded me of the Westerns, you know, the Western shows where the one sheriff and he's got the shotgun and the mob is coming towards the jail and the guy is just standing there with the shotgun. Like, you can't go any farther than this. And when they get up to them and he goes, what are you here for? And they go, well, I don't know. What are we here for? And by the time that they got there, they forgot about why they were so upset. That's just a funny way to explain it, but, and this wasn't a funny scene at all, but it was, it got to the place where it was so confusing and there was so many people milling all around and one crying one thing and another crying another thing that nobody knew really what was it was all about. They didn't really realize that it was about the commerce that had to do with Demetrius and his fellow silversmiths. So let's go and read 33 now. And the people of the Judeans who were there put forward a Judean man of them whose name was Alexander. And when he stood up, he waved his hand and wanted to make a defense to the people. Hello, hello, you know, trying to get people's attention, right? But he was a Jew. So it says, and knowing that he was a Judean, all of them cried out with one voice for about 2 hours, great is Diana of the Ephesians! Great is Diana of the Ephesians! We don't want you! You're just as bad as all the Paul guys, you know? Just get out of here! And they would not listen to him at all. And then they started this mantra, a chant, which is also pretty typical of a mob scene. Yes, you've seen pictures of Tiananmen Square in China or descriptions of times when there was mob rule. It's usually got some sort of chant thing going after a while. So that's what they were just chanting. 2 hours, can you imagine? So by the time they would say that for 2 hours, you know, would they be getting hoarse and, whoa, great is Diana of Ephesians. Yeah, great is Diana of Ephesians. Great is Diana of Ephesians. You know, how many times can you say it over and over and over again? But anyway, so what happened was the ruler of a city came. He was like the mayor. And he must have been respected, or at least a person who was recognizable in the middle of this mob. So somebody to come that they knew he had authority. So he would be like a mayor. And sometimes it's called a scribe or the clerk of the city. So he was well known to the people. The ruler of the city quieted them, saying, men, Ephesians, for who are the men who do not know that the city of the Ephesians is the priestess of the great Artemis and her image that came down from heaven? So he's telling them what they already want to hear. See, in order to get their attention and get control of the crowd, he starts telling them, yeah, you guys are great worshipers. You're wonderful. You're just awesome. And, you know, this is nothing about how great Diana is. Of course she's great. She came down from heaven. You know, she is the priestess of our city. And they're going, yeah, okay, we'll listen to you. Therefore, because no one can speak against this, you ought to be quiet. Oh, okay. You ought to be quiet and not do anything in haste. For you have brought these men here, although they have not stolen from the temples, nor reviled our goddess. Now, if this Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a controversy with someone, behold, the proconsul is in the city. They are craftsmen, so they should go near and judge one with the other. So he basically turns the tide. It's kind of like the sheriff, you know. What are you complaining about? Let's hear it out. Okay, well, you have this complaint. Let's go take care of it this way. The proconsul was the Roman governor of the city. And if you started mentioning his name, it's like saying, I'm taking you to the president. Or, you know, I'm taking you to the highest sheriff of the land. And, oh, well, maybe we ought to rethink this about, you know, doing a mob scene in the middle of the theater. So he was really able to quiet the people and to turn their thinking away from that mob scene and start being a little bit more logical again. Verse 39, and if you are seeking someone else, let it be settled in a place that is given by the law for an assembly. So now they're the people are worried about, oh, am I going to be arrested? And as soon as a mob figures out that they're going to be arrested for what they're doing, they go, they just disappear, you know. And that's basically what happened. It says, because now we also stand in danger of being accused as troublemakers because we are not able to give a reason for the crowd of this day because we have been assembled needlessly and made an uproar without a cause. And after he'd said these things, he dismissed the crowd. And they just went away and realized, this is not worth it. It's not our dime that we're worried about here. We're not the ones making all this money. What are we worried about? And some of the Russian programs, I guess they call it, yeah, it was like that too. And times where the crowd or the mob would get together, they would realize, this is not our fight. And we don't get anything out of it either. So by the time the logic finally sinks in, then they disperse. So that's basically the scene that happened in Ephesus. It's pretty amazing. So chapter 20, verse 1 says, after the uproar had subsided, Paul called for the disciples and comforted them and kissed them and left and went to Macedonia. And when he had gone about those regions and had comforted them with many words, he came to the country of Greece. Now, Paul had already wanted to go to Macedonia and had planned to. This sort of just facilitated it happening a little earlier than what he thought it was going to be. And in some ways, it was a pressure for him to move on from a physical standpoint, you know, having this riot, having the crowd be all stirred up. But I'm certain that he asked God, is it time to go? Because if it wasn't time to go, then God would have taken care of him. But God said, yeah, time to go. So then they left there. They went to Macedonia where Timothy and Erastus had already gone. So they're going back up to Macedonia. Now the cities in Macedonia are Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea. And eventually Paul is going to be going towards Jerusalem. That's his plan. He wants to go to Jerusalem, bring money for the saints there, and then he wants to go to Spain. While he's in Macedonia, he writes 2 Corinthians. And that's the one which, when he gets a report back from Corinth that the people have repented and they are getting their lives back together and things are much, much better in Corinth, then he writes 2 Corinthians and just deals with a few other things that had been from reports from Corinth. And then he actually goes to Corinth for the third time right after that and spends 3 months there. And while he is in Corinth, he writes the book of Romans. So then when you read Romans, and especially at the end of Romans, just take a peek at it really quick, Romans 16, the people that he's referring to at the end of chapter 16 of Romans are people that are with him in Corinth, and they're sending greetings to the believers in Rome. And verse 21, it says, Timothy is there, right? Timothy, a worker with me, greets you. And Lucius and Jason and Sosipater, my kinsman, there's Sosipater. I, Tertius, who wrote the letter. So there's a man named Tertius. Gaius, my host, and a host of all the church, greets you. Erastus, the steward of the city. Excuse me. And Quartus, a brother. They all greet you. And those were some of the people that were with Paul at this particular time in Corinth. So now, in just summarization here, what happened to Ephesus? As we go on, Paul actually never goes back all the way into Ephesus from this time, as it turns out. But look at Acts chapter 20. when he's coming back through, he goes to a little town called Miletus, which is close by Ephesus. So a lot of the believers come to greet him there. And he tells this summary in Acts chapter 20 about what he actually did in Ephesus. And I think it's a really great summary, so I wanted to read it. Verse 25, "And now I know that you will not see my face again, all of you for whom I have traveled and preached the kingdom." Now, how did he know that he wasn't going to see them again? Yeah, God told him. And part of, he wasn't thinking that he was going to get in prison. He was thinking that he was going to go to Rome, and then he was going to go to Spain, and it was very likely that that tour was going to take a lot of years, and that it would be almost impossible to come back to Ephesus. Verse 26, "And because of this, I witness to you this very day that I am pure from the blood of all of you, for I have not refused to make known to you all the will of God." Wow, could we really say that when we were preaching and teaching, that you made known all the will of God? That's pretty wild, though. "Watch, therefore, over yourselves and over all the flock over which the Holy Spirit has appointed you overseers, to feed the church of God that he purchased with his blood." So he's giving them a charge, the leaders of Ephesus. "I know that after I'm gone, fierce wolves will enter among you without mercy on the flock. And also from yourselves there will rise up men speaking perverse things to turn away the disciples to follow them." Oh my goodness, those are hard words that are, you know, a little hard to take. I mean, if the leader that you respected came and said, "Grievous wolves are going to come among your flock and tear it to pieces," and even if you're watching, that's what was going to happen. Verse 31, "Because of this, you should be vigilant and remember that for 3 years I did not stop by day and by night admonishing each one of you with tears. And now I commend you to God and to the word of his grace that is able to build you up and to give you an inheritance with all the holy ones." So he's commending them to the word of his grace. Doesn't that sound familiar about commending them to the grace of God? "Silver or gold or garments I have not desired, and you know that these hands ministered to my necessity and to those who were with me." Who were the people with them? Priscilla and Aquila. They had worked together in Ephesus in their craft, and that's why he can say this. Verse 35, "And I demonstrated everything to you, that so it is right to labor and to care for those who are weak, and to remember the words of our Lord Jesus, because he said, 'He who gives is more blessed than he who receives.'" So he uses himself in saying, "I worked with my hands, I worked as a craftsman with Priscilla and Aquila, so that I wouldn't have to be accountable to you, so I could be free to preach." Now, that was Paul's situation. And he said, it's better to give than to receive, in the sense that it was better to have him be free to preach what God wanted him to do and go where God wanted him to go and not be obligated to people. Verse 36, "And when he said these things, he kneeled down and prayed, and everyone with them. And there was great weeping among all of them, and they embraced him and kissed him. But they were the most anguished about that word that he said, that they were not going to see his face again. And they accompanied him as far as the ship." So what exactly happened in Ephesus is what Paul said, is that originally and through the end of the first century, there was a great move, and there continued to be a great move because of people releasing themselves from the spell, the magic, the worship of Diana, the prostitution, all those things. But gradually there came in wolves that kind of took over. And by the end of the time when the Apostle John was in Ephesus, it had started to disintegrate. If Ephesus was still a main Christian center, though, through the 4th or 5th centuries. So now there's one last thing, this Demetrius guy. There's another Demetrius in the Bible, and it's in 3 John. So we're going to look at that real quickly here. 3 John, And in verse 12. So this is John writing to Gaius. Now Gaius is a man from Corinth. And he says, about Demetrius, there is a testimony from everyone and from the church and from the truth. And also we bear him testimony and you know that our testimony is true. Now my question I want to leave you with, is this the same Demetrius the silversmith who actually ended up getting born again and turning to be a wonderful example of a Christian man, so that by the time John is writing the third epistle of John, that he is a leader in the church in Ephesus. Is it true or is it not? We don't know. God bless you.